death. If normality is... When one regards a certain made thing, which can be a song, such as the song whispered above, but which is now here an object, let's call it a soft corpse, recomposed in light fabric, the object draws the attention away from and toward communication. The soft corpse is aesthetic to a degree. The fact of the corpse being a corpse rather than a symbol of a corpse or a corpse in a narrative context has been illuminated to a degree. One looks at the soft corpse draped in something pale and elegant, but with tears in the fabric here and there. Under the torn fabric is fabric. We see the corpse is bloodless to a degree. The psychological effect of our cognizing the object as a corpse is we observe the missing blood of the corpse in our thought. Our thought supplies blood where we perceive none. In other words, the thoughts are not bloodless. We are not a bloodless and cutthroat people. We understand, even in absence from the wars, the fact of atrocity. The objects entrust this fact to the viewer. It is not certain what the viewer will do with the trust. Sometimes people want to be certain what the viewer will do with the trust. In this case, the object is dismissed as inadequate or attacked for its complexity and its meshing of aesthetic and social concerns. If you can't trust others' response to the object, you better make their choices clearer is an edict we have known. But if you make their choices clearer, then the object loses its blood, the blood that is in the thoughts of the viewer. If the viewer loses her bloody thoughts, what then? Furniture? We can't infer much more about her without going very far out, probably too far out on a limb. You and I can therefore pause for a moment. Initiate an illicit strike in the foregone conclusion of our intimacy, live a little longer. Still alive is the motto of the mildly conspiratorial living that has molded us into the delicate creatures we had hoped to become. This is the beauty and the paradox of the aesthetic artifact called a corpse. A theory or language might tell us there is no difference between, let's say, a depiction of a corpse in a photograph in a war zone and the artifact of the body which has been made into what we call a work of art. Language, which for some is not suspect, shows us the work of art is to be suspected. Language says the corpse is a corpse. It cannot distinguish between one body and another. Therefore, the photographed corpse in a war zone is a universal corpse. We all die. Death is inevitable, even if, as we can see, this particular death was violent. It came too soon. We know this. And you and I are still alive, mastering what is literally true. However, the made form, having never lived, is beautified. Death has become beautified. The beauty of the object betrays the universality of death. Many come here to see this, to observe these things, to prevent violence from falling into the hands of beauty, and to protect war from its associations with death. As these associations, like those you and I enjoy in our nondescript day, going about things without notice, also have their conspiratorial features. It is true we have come to know one kind of conspiracy through another. The conspiratorial feeling, its skin touch and verve, has been tossed into a different salad, one served around the world, but not in my backyard where I have already eaten. So many elements have been added to our discourse. I can hardly brush them off as if they were flies feasting on the sweat of my brows or the rump of my dog. However, this is not the function of the aesthetic object. The purpose of the object is to produce a thought response and a somatic response simultaneously intertwined along with an aesthetic response. The made corpse is beautiful. This is the aesthetic response. The made corpse, an object that represents the body, is also beautiful in our thoughts. The human body is an object of beauty, and even in death it is beautiful, even as it is and is not a maimed thing. Some people claim the human body is only beautiful in its most ideal form, but this is something I have never personally been able to corroborate. We hold this to be true, just as we have held and desire to hold other bodies to our own. Nearby and under siege and forgetting where the others are and who they are, but falling into our likeness, we sometimes repeat ourselves in the manner of sheepish clichés under trees' shade, falling on each other while making their distance known to those who graze up the slope. Sometimes the enterprise is lonely. There is no other body to hold, and even though we forget many things, we do not forget what it is to hold and to be held. Yet, I supply a contradiction in respect to the numerous occasions in which I have heard the phrase, "I had forgotten." The artist may have been lonely when she made this beautiful yet deformed body. The body is placed such that you can sidle up to it. It is available for viewing somewhere in a public space, a gallery or museum or park bench or sidewalk on the ground next to your feet, or in an open market. Imagine a beautiful, luminous, soft voile fabric in a variety of green, blue, purple, red, and yellow hues that tend toward but do not remain always in the pastel registers. You feel you are looking at the contents of a garden suspended in the air and shot through with cloud effects, earth also supports the sky and vice versa, including rain. These are tones. All of this is formed with the help of some delicate wire supports inserted into the figure of a corpse. The corpse has a plastic quality as it lies there in peace. Imagine that you could hold its hand and it might squeeze yours in response. Or perhaps you could move its leg to a more restful position. Perhaps the most restful position, which is the position between longing and defeat. In my survey of this most significant landscape of the human soul, its form as the thing it is not, I find at the bend of an arm a not insignificant tear in the fabric, which is also the same thing as its actual substance. There is no difference between voile and skin. On the left side of the neck, under the ear, between the jaws and the collarbone, is another tear, several inches long. One finds another tear at the pelvis and one just above the foot. These tears are where the blood was let. These tears are the imperfections opening the object to the mind. Without them, there would be no beauty or blood. The artist took out a small pliers. She cut, wrapped, and formed some wire, stretching it to the length of a full human form. She stuffed and wrapped the form with fabric until the colors began to communicate, one with the other in shifting locations, spilling from the thoughts, words, and perceptions of the artist through her hands, which could do things even a perception in isolation could never manage on its own, as the hands were extended and could go further out, could range with greater fluidity than one could infer from something that had already been decided. The hands made the decisions with neither words in mind nor an object derived from them, unless one backs into the anterior zone of the already given form produced by one thing leading to another and carving out a name for itself. Then she took out a small scissor and, snipping lovingly, opened some of the fabric. In the open spaces, she pulled with both her hands and the ends until the fabric split irregularly. She did this in several other places, her fingers tugging and feeling at their tips and fabric threads, such that the body itself was torn in parts visible to a viewer. She said she did this because there were so many bodies before this one to have been torn.